Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 531st episode of the Hollywood Reporter's Awards Chatter podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and this episode was recorded live in front of an audience at the Boulder International Film Festival, where I sat down with the recipient of the festival's 2024 Career Achievement Award for a career retrospective conversation. He is a terrific actor who has shined on stage and screens big and small in projects spanning the 1990 film Ghost through the 2012 through 2018 TV drama series Scandal, through the film that will almost certainly win the Best Picture Oscar a few days from now, Oppenheimer. He's also a gifted director, as has been evident for 25 years now, dating back to his feature directorial debut, 1999's A Walk on the Moon, through his latest film, 2023's Ezra, which had its world premiere at the 2023 Toronto International Film Festival and opened the 2024 Boulder International Film Festival just before we sat down. He's only 63, so there will surely be plenty more achievement in his career, but this event was a wonderful excuse to celebrate his wonderful work so far. Mr. Tony Goldwyn. And so without further ado, let's go to that conversation.
Thanks,
Tony, nice to see you, and congratulations to you. I also want to note congratulations to the Bex. This is 20 years of growing Boulder International Film Festival into a great event, and your being here is a testament to that. So very excited to have you here and get to talk to you. For this podcast, we always go back right to the very beginning. So can we start by asking you where you were born and raised and what your folks did for a living, your answer being a little bit more interesting than most, I think, that we've had on our podcast.
Well, maybe. I was born in Los Angeles and grew up there. My father was a film producer, like his father. My grandfather was one of the sort of pioneers of the movie industry in the very early days, Sam Goldwyn. And then my mom was an actress and then became a painter. So I'm like the third generation of show, and my mother's father was a playwright and a great screenwriter, and so yeah, and her mother was an actress, so the showbiz goes far back in my
family. And while stipulating, and we'll get more to this in a moment, that you were, you know, initially, I know, not particularly even interested in pursuing film, you know, you had a fascinating perspective on film history because you were, I believe 13, almost 14 at the time Samuel Goldwyn, your grandfather, passed away.
Right.
So I imagine you got to spend some time with him. Can you, what
yeah,
stands out?
Yeah, we were very
out?
Close. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me, like, what stands out to
I
you?
I mean, he was 80 when I was born. So, you know, it was kind of great because I just knew him as my grandpa and we were very, very close. He was quite, you know, ill toward the end of his life. And I spent a whole lot of time with him because he couldn't work anymore. And to me, he was this, it's funny if you know this sort of history of these guys who founded this industry, they were tough. And Sam Goldwyn was a sort of a famous tyrant. Yeah. And people were terrified of him. And yet to me, he was just so sweet. You know, the one image I always had, you know, like in The Godfather, there's this scene toward the end of the very end of The Godfather, when Marlon Brando's running around the Rose Garden with his grandson. I don't know if you remember that scene. And the kid, you know, he's hiding from him and he puts in the fake scary teeth and stuff. And I was like, oh, that was like my grandpa. That was because everyone was terrified of the guy. And yet to me, he was just a sweet old man.
And an amazing, like, embodiment of the American dream. I think 13, he literally walks across Europe.
Yeah.
Then comes to America. I think he's a glove maker. Mm-hmm. And Shmuel Gelbfish,
right,
becomes Samuel Goldwyn. Samuel Goldwyn. Right?
Then became Samuel Goldwyn, yeah.
And amazing. Now, your father was also a remarkable man in film and for many years, and just a great producer. And I know really shaped you in a lot of ways, not necessarily to go into the film business, but what, as you think back about your father, do you think kind of shaped you the most?
Well, I would say there's two things I would share, I guess. One of the things that my father did say to me all the time, but that I also sort of absorbed by osmosis in my family, is that this business is a working person's business. And it wasn't about, you know, all the sort of glitz and glamour, or the sense of fanciness is not honestly what it's not what it's like. You know, there are moments, but that's really the promotion of things. But it really is a working person's endeavor, and it's very challenging and hard and driven by deep passion to do it, which all of my forebears had that burning passion. And it's, as my dad used to say, it's a survivor's game. And it's not about making it when you're 20. It's about still doing it when you're 50 and beyond. So that really stuck with me a lot.
And I think
a
it's a theme that will
and here
people
we are.
Will come to realize. You have reinvented yourself so many different times in your career. We'll get into it. But I mean, the kind of most amazing thing is, at first, my sense, going back reading like the earliest interviews and stuff with you, there was no particular interest in film. You were going after a career in the theater. And that was starting, I guess, at a pretty young age, going through college, even after college. Why the theater versus film?
Well, you know, my mom's, as I briefly mentioned, my mom's family was really from the theater. She had been an actress in New York, and her father was a playwright called Sidney Howard, who was a really, and a very important American playwright in the 20s and 30s, and died in the mid-career. He'd just written the screenplay for Gone with the Wind and won an Oscar posthumously the year he died. And had written one of, anyway, he was a person of the theater. And so my parents, this is partially law, I'll try not to make this too long-winded. They were very paranoid about us becoming Hollywood brats. So they kept us completely away from the movie business. Like, I never met a movie star in my entire childhood. I never went to a movie set. My dad could have been a lawyer or an insurance salesman. Well, you know, I knew what he did, but I was never exposed to any of that. But I was exposed to the theater, and we went all the time. And the actors I did meet were my parents' friends who were theater actors. And then I went to New York when I was about 10 and went to see plays, and I was just entranced. So that held a lot of romance for me. And then just, you know, in high school, you start doing plays, which I only did because my brother was doing them, my older brother. And then I got the bug, which anybody who has it knows, it's just like being shot up with adrenaline.
And this was,
you know, it was what you're meant to do. And so then you're like, okay, that's what I got to do.
And you did it at Hamilton College, did it at Brandeis University,
our
shared alma mater. You did it at Lambda, right?
Yeah,
for a little bit.
Yeah, for drama school, yeah.
And in fact, 1985, New York stage debut. And I guess, was it in New York that you first started getting cast in screen roles? Which, I just, before you even respond, I want to mention some of these early credits. So you were on St. Elsewhere in the 7th season. You and Denzel Washington, this is one of your first, maybe your first job. Must have been a bit intimidating, right in the deep end there, hit show. We've got you that same year, 1987, in Designing Women, but this is, it's a funny show and it's a sitcom, but the amazing thing, Tony's playing a guy in 1987, before I think even the President of the United States is talking about AIDS, a guy who's dying of AIDS and asks the women to design his funeral because his parents have disowned him.
Well, Linda Bloodworth Thomason, who created that great show. It's funny, I just did Hacks with Gene Smart.
Yeah. Was in it. Oh, yeah.
The brilliant Gene Smart.
Yeah.
But Linda's mother, she's the writer, creator of Designing Women, her mom had died of AIDS from a blood transfusion. And this was 1987. Like you said, the word had not been spoken. Nothing had ever been done on television about it. And Linda said, I'm writing a show about this. And it was the first thing on primetime television where AIDS was mentioned.
Yeah.
And it was in a sitcom. So
it
was, and it actually, to this day, people come up to me, you know, gay men or my age or older, and say, you have no idea what that meant to our community. You know, they remember it very, like, they'll start crying, talking to me about it. And I'm like, wow, you know, I was just a kid, like, grateful to have a job.
Amazing. It gets, I don't want to say even better, but just as good here with the next year, but probably shot around the same time. You were in the pilot of Murphy Brown.
Right.
This is all like the first year or so. These are not star making, wealth making roles, but
no, they weren't.
Just to show where we start, where this all started. Then I think your first film role, there is a great movie, Gabby.
Mm-hmm. That was actually my second.
Second.
The first is an epic masterpiece called Friday the 13th, okay. Part 6. Where I was stabbed through the heart by Jason in the first 2 minutes of the movie. 1985 or 6, I think.
I stand corrected.
Yeah, but Gabby was a
Gabby's
real film.
A great movie.
Lee Volman. Robert Loggia and a great Argentine actress called Norma Alejandro. And
absolutely.
Directed by Luis Mendoki, who was a great Mexican director.
And this is a young woman who had cerebral palsy, and you're the older brother, and highly recommend people check that out. But this was the beginning. You were on your way to these small roles in films, but essentially you were a guest star on TV. That was how it was going,
pretty
right?
Much.
And so this is 87, 88. How, at a time when people were kind of, in those days, much more segregated. You're either a TV actor or a film actor. How did you make the jump into film in a real way in a little movie called Ghost?
Yeah, it was hard. I mean, what you said is so right. You know, in the 80s, you could not work in movies and television. It was like you were slumming. If you made it into movies, you were slumming in television. And if you were in television, it was very hard to break in. You were just known as a TV actor. So I'd been working in the theater, you know, to make a living, yeah. I'd do these guests, do whatever parts I could get, but I couldn't even get auditions for movies. And, my wife, Jane, who actually Tony Spiridakis introduced me to in 1981, we were all at the Williamstown Theater Festival in Massachusetts. That's where Tony and I met. And he introduced me to Jane, and we've all been fast, friends since then. But Jane is a very successful production designer, movie production designer. And she's a few years older than me, so she had started her career, and she was doing all these big movies. She did the first two Coen Brothers movies, Blood Simple and Raising Arizona. She did When Harry Met Sally. She did all these in the 80s. You know, her career was blowing up.
Yeah.
While I was sitting home unemployed waiting for the phone to ring. And so one of them is she did Ghost, right? She gets this big movie, and I was having a tough year, man. I did the pilot for Murphy Brown, but like I kept not getting jobs, and I was really feeling despondent. And she would come home and go, "They haven't cast the villain part. There's this one part they haven't cast in this part." I'm like, "Jane, they're never gonna cast me. That's one of the leads in the movie." She said, "You call your agents," and she was on me about it. So I call my agent, who literally wouldn't take my phone calls. So, and they were like, "Yes, he'll call you back." And then the assistant finally said, "You know what? I'm going to get you in on that. You should get an audition for that." So the assistant got me on to put on tape for Ghost.
Wow.
And he was this guy, Michael Lazo, who I'm forever grateful for, got me an audition. And I just went on tape and then I thought I did pretty well. And the casting directors were very nice, but I didn't even get to meet the director. So then I heard nothing. You know, months went by. I was like, I'm done with this.
Yeah.
And I went back to New York. I got actually asked to be in a play at Williamstown in the theater for the summer. And I was like, I'm going, whatever. And I was in rehearsal for that play 2 months later. And they come to me, and this is before cell phones, right? The stage manager says, "Tony, your agent called." I was like, "My agent never calls me." "What?" "Yeah, you got to." So I go to the pay phone and I call my agent, Brian. I said, "What's up?" He says, "Hey, remember that movie Ghost? They want to screen test you. They saw your tape and they really like you and they want to fly you to LA on your day off and do a proper screen test." I was like, "That's crazy." So I flew to LA on the Monday off and did my screen test, which was like in the old days, they really did. You'd go to the studio and they'd have a big set and you do a proper thing in front of a camera, which now they don't do anymore. It was so thrilling. I was just glad to do that. And then, you know, lo and behold, it worked out. And a couple of weeks later, I was suddenly in this movie. I don't know. It was just total luck.
Not that,
And marrying the right woman.
Yeah, right. Well, I think this is not a spoiler 34 years later, but we'll just remind folks you were playing Carl Brunner.
Right.
This is a yuppie banker who essentially deceives his best friend, played by Patrick Swayze, who is killed. And then has a relationship still in the afterlife with his girlfriend, wife?
His girlfriend, yeah.
Girlfriend, played by...
Hopefully soon to be wife, but they're not married.
Right,
yeah.
Demi Moore.
And star of Ezra, Whoopi Goldberg.
That's right.
Won an Oscar the movie.
Whoopi won, exactly. And the original screenplay as well,
Screenplay won Oscar, yes. That's right.
So, again, you grew up in a family that had been big in movies, but you yourself had not been at the center of a big movie before, a role like this. It turns out to be this giant hit. How early on in the process did you realize it might be more than just sort of your run-of-the-mill movie?
Not until it opened.
Really?
I was so grateful to be having the experience, having struggled for 5 or 6 years,
yeah.
Wondering if I would ever make it work. The day I pulled up to the Paramount lot and there was like a parking space with my name on it, and I had to walk into the big sound stage, you know, to have my first rehearsal with Demi, and then looking over my shoulder and seeing a stairway to a building where, like, a couple of months before, I'd been made to wait for an hour and a half to audition for some terrible sitcom that I didn't get. And I was just like, never forget, like, how that felt and how, like, appreciate you're here.
Absolutely.
So I was just trying to be present in the experience. It was an amazing... What I thought was, this movie could be good. Like, the script was so commercial. It just felt like, wow, if this is done well, it could be very good. But you never know, man. No one had any awareness of that movie. Patrick's career was kind of on a bit of a downslide. Mm-hmm. Whoopi hadn't been in a hit for a while. People didn't really know who Demi was yet. And audiences just discovered it. And it became an overnight, like, juggernaut. It was crazy. It was one of those weird... It's happened a couple of times in my career where things just... Audiences find them.
Now let's talk about the implications of this for you, because everybody sees Ghost. You are a very bad guy in Ghost. How did that affect your life off the screen and in terms of opportunities on the screen?
Well, look, I mean, it made it... Suddenly I was in the game, you know, so I was able to support my family, and Jane and I had a baby, because we're like, okay, maybe this will work out. She was actually conceived during the filming of Ghost. It's the only time we've ever been together.
Yeah.
You know, so I was a bit, for many years, kind of typecast as the villain all through the 90s. I got a lot of in the studio movies I did, I tended to be like the bad guy. And then I did other things in more indie movies, and did a lot in the theater still. People would hiss me walking down the street. That's true. you know, but it sure beat the hell out of unemployment. I can tell you that.
So in the ensuing few years, well, actually, here's the best. So everybody, I'm sure now, as this movie's a hit, has an opinion about what you should do next. You did the opposite of what anyone would have advised. Can you share what you did immediately after Ghost and why it actually worked out really nicely?
Well, right as Ghost was... with the play that I ended up going to do at Williamstown, the summer we filmed Ghost, was this beautiful Australian play called The Sum of Us. And the next year it moved to New York City. So, and I wanted... It was a great part. I wanted to do it. So the play opened like a month or two, or we ended rehearsal a month or two after Ghost opened. So I did a play in New York, off-Broadway, which was a big hit, actually.
Got an Obie.
I got an Obie Award for it. And it was a beautiful thing, but it was a bit counterintuitive. People were saying, are you insane? You're going to go, you know, you have this big movie in the theater and you're going to go do this play for zero money. And you know, you just got to listen to your gut. And and it was the right decision for me, for sure.
So I'm going to mention a few other projects that were over those next few years. You were Richard Nixon's brother in Oliver Stone's Nixon,
right.
1995. You once said, and I don't know, this maybe since you gave this quote, maybe it's changed, but you said that Oliver Stone, while not the warmest, fuzziest guy in the world, was, quote, the best director I've ever worked with, close quote. Even if he's second or third now, what made him so good?
The thing about Oliver, to me, that was so inspiring is his curiosity, his desire to constantly, how can we make this better? How can we make this better? How can we make this better? and demanding that everybody who came to set have an idea and be on their toes. And he could be horrible to people if they weren't. But I found it really exciting, you know, and he's a very intense dude, but it was really exciting. I mean, for example, he had staged this scene that we did and had this very complicated camera move with a lot of track all laid out before we came in to rehearse. And we came in to rehearse the scene, and he said, you know, Tony, what do you think about this? And I said, well, I could do that, but I was thinking this other way might be more interesting. And he was like, that's better. We're doing that. And he tore apart the whole, they had to stop for 45 minutes, re-took apart all the track and everything. And it was just about what's the best idea. So I found that inspiring as an actor and later as a director.
As a director, yeah. So later that same year, you make your Broadway debut in Holiday. Then movies continue, Kiss the Girls in 97. Not even the first and certainly not the last time you worked with Ashley Judd.
Ashley Judd, yeah.
You had done, is it Cuffs?
Cuffs, yes.
Earlier, you would do...
Divergent
with her. She was...
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
There was more.
I directed her in a movie called Someone Like You.
We're going to come... Yeah. So anyway, just I don't know if that's just a coincidence or if you guys hit it off, but that's a movie people still love, Kiss the Girls. Then here's an interesting one, a HBO limited series or miniseries, as we called them then, 1998, From the Earth to the Moon, you're playing Neil Armstrong. Opposite, the Buzz Aldrin played by a then virtually unknown Bryan Cranston.
Right.
And there will be a reunion we'll talk about with that later as well. But, I mean, at that point, that's literally Tom Hanks saying, come be in my project?
Yeah, yeah. No, I literally got a call from Tom saying, you know, would you come do this?
Not bad.
And it's like, yeah.
Here's something for a certain generation will really perk up about this. The year after that, 1999, you were the voice of Tarzan in a $400 million Disney animated hit,
right.
Tarzan, which I think might have thrilled your own kids as well, right?
When I told my daughter Anna, who was 6 or 7 at the time, that I was doing it, she fell to her knees and said, thank you, Daddy. Thank you.
Now, this brings us to, I think, percolating around that time, maybe even a little before, a sort of, I don't know if it was, I think it started, it seems like, from what I've remembered you saying, as a bit of a disillusionment with acting. How do you go from that, but not having any desire to direct, to directing for the first time?
Yeah, well, it was a slow-ish process. I mean, it was disillusionment with acting. You know, I'd been in Ghost, which was this massive hit, and the same year won an Obie Award, and I literally thought naively, okay, I did it. So now it just happens, right? And I'd said to my agents, okay, make me a movie star. Like, I did my job, you do yours, you know? And it didn't, it was harder than that. You know, like the next movie I made, which Cuffs, was not a success. Then I did a couple other things that, you know, didn't make as much money. And suddenly I went 2 years after being like the super hot, where everyone was like wanting me, and to not being so hot. And I was working and making a living, but not getting the parts that I wanted, being typecast as, you know, another villain, playing the same kind of parts all the time. And it was frustrating, and you know, fighting for things that I either didn't get an opportunity for or that I didn't get because someone who was hotter was getting those parts. And I thought, man, I don't know if another 10 years I'm going to be able to take this lack of agency in my career. And I felt that I had more to offer creatively. I just wanted to be more primary in what I was doing and not just waiting for someone. And then if you play parts that are not great roles, you know, you're kind of, you know, sometimes you feel underutilized, you know, in a movie. You spend a lot of time waiting around and, you know, and then you come in and do your thing and then you wait more. And it just, I was thinking, gosh, is this all that there is? And praying that you get that one that's a big hit again. So anyway, I said, oh, I need to take this into hand. And I started looking for material, thinking I wanted to produce. My thought was, if I could find a great script or two with a great role in it, the next time I was in a hit, because I figured at some point it's going to, you know, you're going to hit the jackpot again. Then I have leverage and I can say, okay, now I have I've leverage. I'm going to, you know, I want to do this script. So I found this very beautiful script that I didn't feel I was right to act in, but I thought the writing was amazing and I wanted to meet the writer. So she liked my ideas for the script and she said, would you produce this with me and help me get it off the ground? I said, sure. And we worked on the script for about 3 years. It was at that time called The Blouse Man. And this wonderful writer, Pam Gray, we just worked on the script and kind of started getting it into really good shape. And I was trying to find a director for it. And I would meet directors and think, oh, they're going to fuck it up. Like, it was a movie that had a lot of potential cliches in it, and it could easily have been done really badly. And I just got nervous that I'd worked so hard. And then one day I was like, oh, I have to do this myself. And honestly, my father, in the years leading up to this, had been going, you're a director. You don't even know it. You should be a director. Like, you are not just an actor. You have a lot more to offer. And he kind of put the bug in my ear, and I was like, I don't know. I don't want to be a director. And I don't know how to do that. And then just something spoke to me. And I, in an instant, just said, oh, that's what I'm going to do. And I told Pam and the writer, and she thought it was a good idea. And then the way this life works, I got a call out of the blue about 2 months later from an agent at CAA saying, hey, you control the rights to The Blouse Man, right? And you want to direct that movie, right? I said, yeah. He said, well, Dustin Hoffman wants to read the script. I said, Dustin Hoffman, what? I hadn't shown anybody the script. And he said, yeah, Dustin's company has just put together a fund to finance independent movies, and they're producing stuff, and he wants to read your script. So I said, okay, and I printed out a copy, and I sent it to them. And 2 days later, something, I get a call saying from his development guy going, please don't make and show this to anybody else. We would like to make a deal on your script. And I went to meet with this guy, Murray Shizgal, who was Dustin's best friend. He was an older guy. Murray's like, so, you want to direct this? And I thought he was going to say I couldn't. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, great. Dusty loves actor directors. Great. It's a great idea. He said, what's your budget? I said, well, and I'd been trying to get the budget under $2 million. But it was a period piece, and I was fighting to get it under $2 million. And I was about to say, well, I'm hoping to make it for under $2 million. And he goes, you think you can make it for $6 million? I said, yeah, I think we probably could do that. And then suddenly we were casting the movie, and 6 months later we were in production, and I was directing a feature film. And I couldn't, with Diane Lane and Viggo Mortensen and Liev Schreiber and Anna Paquin.
Just so people know, this is what became A Walk on the Moon.
Yeah.
And Story of a Young Mother who is, I guess, tempted outside of her marriage.
Has an affair
during the summer of 69.
That's right.
And New York Times critics pick, great reception for a directorial debut. And you kind of had the bug now that this was something you'd want to not do instead of acting, but in addition to acting?
Yeah. Yeah, I never wanted to quit acting, but I just, the whole world opened up. And it actually helped my acting career, honestly. As soon as I did that movie, and the movie was kind of got a lot of attention, and we were at Sundance and all that, suddenly I started getting offers for interesting acting parts. I was like, what? Because I really realized in this business, you have to constantly reinvent yourself.
Right.
And people, once you have something that's successful, which is great, people are like, oh, that's what he does. Or that's what that, you know, people want to, it's just how it works.
Totally.
So then if you constantly are surprising people, then you can keep reinventing yourself. It's kind of fun.
And 2 years after that, you directed again. This is a movie, Someone Like You, which comes back to Ashley Judd
yeah.
as the TV booker who has love problems.
It's a romantic comedy with Ashley and Hugh Jackman,
right,
and Greg Kinnear and Marissa Tomei,
yes,
and Ellen Barkin. Yeah. You loved it? Oh, thanks.
Now, the acting is continuing alongside this, and I'll mention that there was, I think, what you described, at least up to that point, as the largest scale movie you'd ever been a part of was The Last Samurai. This is Ed Zwick, the director. Tom Cruise is your star, and it's 19th century Japan. What stands out to you about that?
It's a really good movie. I mean, Ed is one of the great war movie directors. The battle scenes in that movie are incredible. Tom is great in it. Two amazing Japanese actors, Ken Watanabe, who got nominated for an Oscar for it, and Hiroyuki Sanada, who actually, if anybody's watching Shogun, which just is now on FX and Hulu, he's the lead. He plays Terunaga, and he's brilliant in it. He's incredible in Last Samurai, and does all, he's a samurai master himself, and all the fights in that movie are incredible, really incredible, really worth watching again.
And you said that Tom is, your impression was a really just crazy, hardworking. And
the hardest working man I've ever met in my life.
Wow.
And the most generous leader of people, yeah.
Yeah. Directing now again, continuing alongside this, a bit for TV, which was becoming cool now again. This is The L Word, where you directed 3 episodes, you acted in 2. There's Dexter, directed 4 episodes, acted in 1. The idea of directing something that you're in, which we've obviously just seen with Ezra, but that was not something you resisted that for a while, right?
Yeah, I didn't really want to. Directing is so hard. I didn't, I felt with the movie, it was just too much responsibility to put myself in it. And then television, it was more just easy. I was doing The L Word, and I'd done a couple of them, and Eileen Chaykin, the creator, said, "Hey, I wrote a part for you. Want to do this?" And I said, "Sure, I'll try it." And it was really fun. And then the Dexter, which my brother John produced, I was directing a bunch of them, and there was a character on it, and they were just like, "Why don't you just play the part?" So I thought, well, it's easier than hassling about casting it, so I'll just do it. And it was also fun,
yeah.
Which is the same thing that happened in Ezra.
Yeah, yeah.
John, our brilliant producer, John Killick, and our other producer, Bill Horberg, were like, "Tony, just play the part of Bruce." So I said, okay.
Feature number 3 that you directed was The Last Kiss, 2006. This is a script by Paul Haggis coming off of Crash.
Mm-hmm.
This is a remake of a 2001 Italian movie, Zach Braff, Jacinda Barrett, a bunch of
Casey
people.
Affleck, yeah,
Casey Affleck, Casey Affleck, like the whole next
Tom
generation.
Tom Wilkinson just died, yeah.
Yes. And then feature number 4, which is where I think I first had the opportunity to meet and interview you, was a great movie that I wish had gotten a better release,
mm-hmm.
called Conviction. And this was in 2010, the same writer who you'd worked with.
Pamela Gray,
Pamela
who wrote
Gray,
A Walk on the Moon.
Walk on the Moon. And Hilary Swank and Sam Rockwell as sister and brother. He's a guy who is accused of murder and sentenced to life in prison. She is his sister who goes to law school to get a law degree so that she can, when nobody else believes that he's innocent, she can take up the fight.
True story.
Really amazing. And I was going to say, like, I think you've said your wife may have encouraged you to, or you guys saw that together in the news,
yeah,
or something?
Kenny Waters was his name. Spent 18 and a half years in prison for a murder he didn't commit. And when he got out, Betty Ann, his sister, uneducated, he's never gotten past 10th grade, decided she was the only person who had faith in him and she was going to get him out somehow, as long as he didn't kill himself. That was the deal they made. And she put herself, went back to college, went to law school, became an attorney just to get her brother out. Did it with the help of the Innocence Project, an organization I'm now very deeply involved with. Anyway, so they were on the Today Show when he got out. It was a big thing on the news, all the morning shows and everything. And Jane saw this on the Today Show, I think, and said, "Come see this story. This is an incredible story. This should be a movie." And I missed the story. I was like, "What was it?" And she described it. And I thought, wow. So I chased down Betty Ann and for her rights, and Pam and I started to develop.
And it sounds like, oh, this is what a great, easy Hollywood story. You see something on TV and it becomes a movie. It's got to be a movie. It becomes a movie. This is 8.5 years. Yeah. I remember hearing about it when it was called Betty Ann Waters, and I think was going to star Naomi Watts.
It was a studio movie at Universal, and Naomi was going to be in it.
So it evolved.
And that fell apart.
But yeah, a really good movie and the beginning of sort of the Sam Rockwell renaissance.
Yeah, Sam's brilliant.
He's
in the film. He
should have
gotten
since then,
much more attention than he did for it.
And this then, so that was 2010. Same year going into 2011, you're back on Broadway, Promises, Promises. And this is where things get kind of dramatic again, because you come out of Broadway thinking it is a new world out there for TV. TV is now, as it used to be, if you were going from film to TV, you're going in the wrong direction. Now people were increasingly choosing to go in that direction. And so essentially what you say to your representatives, like, "I'm open to it."
Yeah, what happened was I had never wanted to do a series of television, because it would, especially when I was directing, because you'd sign up for 7 years and I wouldn't be able to direct. So I would just do, you know, I did some guest arcs and stuff once in a while, or movies. So, but I would, I did this movie Conviction, which we all had high hopes for, and it didn't perform at the box office the way that we hoped it would. And I was like, And then I did a year on Broadway in a musical, which was super fun, but came out going, wow, I need to make some money. And my kids were approaching college age, and I was like, television series might be a really smart idea. So I said to my agent, I was like, you know, I'm definitely open to look at stuff now, because I'd been kind of saying no to that. Out of the blue, Shonda Rhimes says, will you want to play the president in my new show with Kerry Washington? I was like, Shonda, Kerry Washington, and the president of the United States. That sounds pretty cool. And I was sort of like, well, what do you think? And my manager said, you're doing it. Shut up. Say yes. This could be a huge hit.
Just to go backwards for a second, the reason your agents and managers or whoever was saying you are doing this is at least in part because Shonda Rhimes was the biggest thing on television because of, at that point, two shows before that, Grey's Anatomy and Private Practice, on which she had reached out for some episodes to be directed years earlier by
me,
Tony
right.
Goldwyn.
Yeah, I directed the third episode of Grey's Anatomy, yeah.
Grey's Anatomy, and then
And then the next year, I did a couple seasons on Grey's, but then I did an early Private
so
Practice.
So she knew about you, was thinking about you, not because of acting specific.
No, that's how, yeah, it's weird. She and Betsy, her partner, were like, Tony Goldwyn would be fun in this. Yeah,
as the president. Yeah.
Crazy.
So this little show scandal, not even ABC was that confident, I guess, at first, because they only ordered 7 episodes initially. And in fact, I think Carrie, correct me if I'm wrong, was the one saying, who, by the way, let's just note, first black lead of a drama series on primetime network TV in 37 years.
Yeah, since Diane Carroll.
Since Diane Carroll. But the thing is, the show better deliver, especially if it's only got 7 episodes. And I think it was pretty early on that it was Carrie's idea, I think, that you guys get on Twitter.
Yes, that's what made the show a hit. It was, you know, because ABC was nervous about it for that reason. And I think the interracial love affair made them nervous. And they, you know, we thought it was really good. And Carrie said, Twitter is a thing. And she said to Shonda, I think we need to get on Twitter and promote the show and have the cast like live tweet with the audience. And I literally didn't know what Twitter was and thought that this 140 characters was the, you know, the devil. The idea of expressing yourself in 140 characters was what was wrong with our society.
You weren't totally wrong. I mean,
I was old. Anyway, we all agreed to do it. And we tweeted with our audience on every Thursday night, 2 hours, because we do with East Coast and West Coast, every night for 7 years. Every week, we all did it. And, you know, if we were working or something, we couldn't. But we were dedicated and developed this relationship with our fans. But the show became a social media sensation almost instantaneously.
Yeah.
Like, the black community discovered us immediately, and then it just spread from there, and then women and then men, and it became this thing. And before ABC, because the ratings were decent, but they weren't sure what they had, and it was trending on anyway, and that's where they picked us up again because of
and
it.
And by the end of this, Shonda had every show on Thursday night on ABC.
Yeah, she owned Thursday nights.
Now the show was sometimes described, I don't know how, if you guys like this way, but as a primetime soap, because of the fact that there were so many just crazy things happening. I wonder, as you look back, what were the ones that involved President Fitz that when you learned about them, whether somebody verbally, Shonda verbally, or somebody else, or you see a script, like where you said, I can't believe this is happening?
two things. The first was when Shonda said to me, okay, I just want you to know that when I told ABC that I was doing this show, they had to be okay with you having sex with Kerry on the desk of the Oval Office. I was like, what? And indeed, she wrote an episode where we had sex on the Resolute desk.
Maybe even not the first, could be.
And it was very bold. So I was like, wow, man, okay. And then the other one was when I strangled a Supreme Court justice to death. You're like, big swings,
yes,
man.
You know,
but it was so much fun. It was so much fun because it was soapy, but then also it was like smart and irreverent and
it's great. Yeah, now, a question that I always had was, Shonda writes these big theatrical monologues, soliloquies, I don't know what you'd call them, and you had to deliver quite a few of them. And I wondered, just how do you even learn and then deliver that kind of a thing? I mean, I guess, let me just leave it there.
It's just a skill you develop. And the challenging thing with working for Shonda, she rewrites up to the last minute.
Oh, no.
So we wouldn't get our scripts often until the night before we started shooting them. And sometimes, I mean, we'd all be in panic that we would have a 3-page monologue the next day and you'd have to like stay up all night. And also Shonda insists word for word accuracy on the script. And in Scandal's case, the rhythm of the show, we spoke at very high velocity. So you had to deliver it very fast and be word perfect. And, you know, good thing you were shooting on, you know, if you screw up, you stop and do it again. But you just developed a muscle. It was, and honestly, she's such a good writer that it wasn't like, when you got the rhythms right, it just kind of played itself. It wasn't, you know, some things you really have to think hard, like, wait, what's my way into this? Or how do I make this work? And she just, her writing is you don't have that problem with it.
Right. We'll note you also directed 9 episodes during the run of Scandal, which was 2012 to 2018, I believe. This is Obama 2 through Trump. Lot was going on in the world as this was happening. Meanwhile, including, by the way, just in terms of what you were also doing while that show was going on, you mentioned Divergent. There are other projects. I guess some you squeezed it in during the hiatuses, but network TV takes a lot of your life for all those years.
Mm-hmm.
And yet when it ends in 2018, instead of going to Maui, you go right into back to Broadway, another hyper fast paced, unbelievable show, which I was lucky to see with you and now a much better known Bryan Cranston, a Broadway play version of Network.
Yeah, the film Network, the 1974 film.
And you're playing the William Holden character, Max. And the thing with this one, I mean, they couldn't have imagined this in 76 or whatever with Sidney Lumet and these guys, but a stage filled with monitors and things that are very modern, to the extent that you and your co-star Tatiana Maslany also, you go outside onto the street in the middle of the show and people are not.
Yeah, the director, this brilliant Dutch director named Ivo van Hove, who's a real visionary, had the idea of doing a satire of the media, which he felt was very timely in our current culture as it was in the 70s, and that Paddy Chayefsky's genius script was prescient, which it is.
Yeah.
So he had, the whole thing was multimedia. So there were cameras on stage filming us while we were acting for the audience. And those stuff was projected on a giant screen behind us and monitors all around the theater. So the audience never knew whether to look at the screen or the real actors or the real people, which was kind of like very meta. And one of the scenes, Tatiana and I had this famous scene between Faye Dunaway and William Holden. But we did it starting out on 44th Street. That suddenly appeared this on this giant screen that we're out on the street in a live New York street with people walking by doing this scene. And then we walked down an alleyway on camera and walk right onto the stage and then have sex on the stage. It's very strange.
It's a recurring theme, I guess. That goes right. Then you go right into your replacement in another great play, The Inheritance, which was only cut short because of COVID.
Right, won the Tony Award for Best Play.
And you, I guess, would have shot this already, but as we're all in lockdown, except then the George Floyd tragedy and the Black Lives Matter protests, while that's happening, HBO puts out a series, so just fortuitously timely, Lovecraft Country, and you are playing a pretty despicable guy in it, but it's a fascinating, you know, look at some of these same issues that everybody was now talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So all of which leads us to the last couple things I'm going to mention before we dive into Ezra, but we have, you've been on a crazy streak of films, you know, the last few years, one of them being King Richard. Mm-hmm. You are the coach of the Williams sisters, Paul Cohen.
Right.
With Will Smith, who ends up winning the Best Actor Oscar, and these two very talented young actresses, Snaya Sidney and Demi Singleton. Anything you want to say about that one?
Oh, man, that was just a beautiful project. It was right in the, it was the first job during the, right in the middle of the pandemic. Obviously Will and Anjanou Ellis, who's so brilliant in that. It was just, and the being around the Williams sisters, both the young imitation Williams sisters and the real ones, Venus and you know, Serena, it was very, it was very exciting to be a part of that. And it was a lovely part and just, yeah. And, Ray Green's a great director and then audiences really appreciate it. It's a great film.
And nominated for the Best Picture Oscar. Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of the Best Picture Oscar, you are also in the movie that on March 10th, 9-10 days from now, is pretty much, I will say, you may not want to say it, but going to win the Best Picture Oscar, called Oppenheimer, Christopher Nolan's movie, and you play Gordon Gray, the chair of the Atomic Energy Commission Committee that's looking into J. Robert Oppenheimer in the 50s. Can you just talk about, this is Nolan at his height of his powers. This guy does stuff that other people can't do, aren't given even the resources to do if they could do it. I mean, he's like a very unique situation. So just your experience working with him.
Yeah, that's, you know, you mentioned Oliver. Christopher is one of the other greats. It was so inspiring for me as a, I don't mean, no false modesty aside, a lesser film, you know, he's really one of the greats. So, and we were about to do Ezra. So I was, it was, the great thing about that was really to work with Chris and just be on set with him and see how he functioned. And so it was, and in the role, like I didn't, I'm sort of in the movie a lot, but I don't say a lot. So I'm in this hearing room, for those of you who've seen the movie or if you haven't, it's intercut throughout the movie, this hearing that ultimately strips Oppenheimer of his security clearance, horrifyingly. And I lead that commission. But there's all these actors testifying, all these people, characters come in. And so every day, man, it was like, one day is Matt Damon doing this incredible monologue. And I'm just going, yes, General. Thank you, General. Please have a seat, General. Well, what do you think, General? You know, and yet I'm watching Matt Damon just kill it. And then, or whoever.
Cillian,
you know,
Murphy.
Cillian, okay. Murphy every day. And Emily Blunt and all these amazing actors doing their thing, man. That was really, being in that movie was sort of like being in film school. And Chris has a very specific way of working that I found very inspiring. So it was
including no phones on set, right?
Yeah, no devices anywhere near the set.
Yeah, was there something about not even? I mean, your character may be sitting, but other than that, like I heard,
people say that there are no chairs. I hear there are no chairs. We had chairs.
Okay, good.
People don't go back to their trailers. Everybody is, well, here's the thing, which is kind of interesting. And if there are filmmakers in the room and the, you know, the what's become customary on film sets are things, many things that waste a lot of time. So it used to be in the olden days, including when I started directing, the director was on set standing by the camera, next to the camera, watching the actors. What has developed really with television and very high quality monitors and all of that is that the director sits away from the set watching a monitor, a high definition monitor of the performance, and doesn't really, you know, or go and then come in to talk to the actors and then go back and watch the thing and then go back. And then there's all these other people around the monitors, producers and other people sort of hovered around and talking. And Chris allows no monitors at all. There's no, what they call that, video village. It doesn't exist on his set. So no one can see what's going on. He has a tiny monitor around his neck that he can kind of check the shot. But that dude is by the camera at crew call, which is when everyone shows up for work in the morning. He never leaves. Maybe he goes to the bathroom. I didn't see it. He takes a lunch break and then comes back, but he's by the camera all the time. And what that does is it just keeps everyone's, the director's there. So normally when the lighting setups happen between shots, the director will go off and make a phone call or go back to Video Village and talk to somebody. He doesn't move. So the whole lighting, everyone's just very like, Christopher's right there. Or if they have a question, they're, because what happens often is as the director, you're back at the Village and you're talking to somebody and someone will go, hey, Tony, you know, the DP has a question. They just have a question about what do you want the shot to be or the camera or the light. And you're like, oh, okay, I'll come in and answer that question. Well, if you're right there, you're and you save hours in a day. There are no stand-ins on his set, which are the people that when the actors are, you know, when the scene's being lit, the actors will rehearse. And then while, you know, it's kind of tiring, you don't just stand there, it takes a while to light. They typically will have stand-ins who stand in for the actors while the actors can rest and prepare to act. And and then they can light with a human being standing, you know, in doing the actor staging. He doesn't allow that. So there's no stand-ins. So the actors, either a crew person will just stand there if they need someone to light, or if they specifically need, they go, Tony or Killian or whoever, please come and just, we need to check something in the light, which is not that onerous. and it just saves time.
Do you think you will take anything from the way he works to the way you direct next time?
I did.
You did with Ezra.
I tried to get no stand-ins, but then we weren't allowed to. SAG didn't allow it. They were like, no, you have to have stand-ins. So we did. It was fine.
So you pretty much went right from Oppenheimer to shooting Ezra.
Pretty, right, guys? Yeah. I shot that in May, and then we went right into pre-production, yeah.
So pre-production, if we take it in the largest sense on this one, goes back years and years before you were even attached to direct. How did you first learn that Tony S. was interested in writing a script?
So I told you, Tony and I are oldest friends, right? And like I said, godfathers of each other's children. We've been best man at weddings, all that stuff. So, you know, Tony had been through this extraordinary experience with Dimitri raising his son. And 10, 12 years ago said, I want to write a movie about it. So I was like, you should. So he started working and he wrote this really beautiful script that I never thought about directing. I would just periodically, he'd send me a draft as we often share our work with each other. I'll always, if I'm working on a script, I'll get his notes. Or if I'm in a performance, I'll ask him to come give me notes on it. And vice versa, I read all of his scripts. And it was just like that. And he worked on it for years. And I think at one point he wanted to direct it himself. And, you know, it was just so, I hadn't read it for a couple of years. And he called me, well, now it's 3 years ago. And said, I've rewritten, it used to be called Inappropriate Behavior. And he said, I've rewritten Inappropriate Behavior and would you take a look at it? And I read it. And I started really getting itchy, honestly. I didn't tell him this. I was wanting to direct again. I was feeling the bug again. And I read it and I was like, Tony, whatever you did in this past, you cracked the story. Like, this really is working. And I think we should do it together. I think I want to direct it. And he might have had that in mind. I don't know if you did. But he didn't tell me that was what he was thinking. But he was like, really? So we kind of teamed up and got to work on the script. And within a year, we kind of felt we had it dialed in. It was during the pandemic. And we worked on the script through the pandemic. And then the fall of 21, we went to Bobby Cannavale to see if he'd want to do it. And Bobby said yes. And then Bobby had some notes on the script. He did like a reading. And then a couple of months later, we thought, well, we're ready to show it to De Niro, who was our first choice for Stan. And miraculously, De Niro said yes. And then as soon as De Niro said yes, it was like, okay, we're making this movie, so we better pull this together fast, because his agent was like, yes, Bob will do it and you have to shoot in 2 months or something like that. He has these weeks available and that's when you're doing it. So, you know, I was like, Tony and I were like, holy shit. And we were kind of doing it by ourselves. And his agent, Josh, said to me, De Niro's agent said to me, Tony, are you producing this by your, who's producing this? And I said, why? I kind of, he said, have you done this by yourself? I said, well, yeah, kind of. He said, you need real producers on this. You need to pull. So we put out the, you know, the SOS and reached out to two people who Tony and I, through different, you know, connections knew, through a miracle, John Killick, who's with us tonight, who is one of the great, great producers in Hollywood and has produced some of your favorite movies that you've ever seen, and who Tony and I both knew through different channels, and our other producer, Bill Horberg, who literally was the studio executive on Ghost.
Wow.
At Paramount. That's how I met him. And at the same time, hired Tony Spiridakis to write Tony. He gave Tony his first studio job as a screenwriter that same year, I think, that Ghost came out. So he knew Bill and I knew Bill. And Bill and John are old friends and had just produced a movie together the previous year. And they both separately were sent the script and loved it. And then they talked to each other and were like, I'm reading the same script. We should do it together. And in a matter of like a week, this, and John has a long relationship with Bob De Niro because he produced A Bronx Tale with Bob. And, you know, so it was just all this synergy. And we like, and Bill pulled together the financing literally in a month. And yeah, we were making a movie.
I mean, this is an incredible cast, A-list, top talent after top talent. And but a key thing was obviously you don't have a movie if you don't have a very talented kid to play your lead, your title character. How did you find Mr. Fitzgerald?
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, Tony and I knew, we all knew if we didn't have an Ezra, we didn't have a movie. And we knew we wanted to cast a neurodivergent actor. We had to, you know, we could not cast a neurotypical actor to play Ezra. We had to have an autistic kid. So we, our brilliant casting directors, Carrie Barden and Paul Schnee, you know, put out a big search, and we reached out to every autism community we find. And Tony was very connected in that world, as is Bill Horberg, who has an autistic son. And we just put out the feelers, and we saw almost 100 autistic young actors, most of whom had never acted before, from all over the country and some in Canada. And we kind of narrowed it down to a couple who were very, very interesting. And we flew them into New York to read with Bobby. And we didn't find the kid. Like, Bobby called me and was like, they were really wonderful, but they're not the guy. And I said, I know. And we were about 3 weeks away from shooting. And it was Harry. And the next day, I got a call from Carrie Barden, our casting director. And he said, you know, we just got this tape. A new tape just came in. And I think you want to see this kid. And he turns out he lives in New Jersey, which is where we're actually shooting the movie. And I said, and I looked at William, and he did this thing, his audition. I'll just tell you, he read the scene. One of the scenes he read was the scene in the woods, the big blow up scene, right? And that's hard. And William had never acted before. And he did this scene, and he does this scene. I'm not your son. I'm not, you know, you're not my, you're, but if I'm your kid, you're my dad. You're my dad. You're my dad. And he's like crying. And then he goes, cut. And he collapses. Like that. And we were like, that's the kid. That's the dude. I mean, he just like went for it. And then he had this irreverent thing. And so we said, can he come in on Monday and meet with Bobby? And he came into the city, and we met him in the, and so Tony was in the casting room with Bobby where we were going to film. And I said, I want to go meet the kid. And he was there with his parents. And I go out, and my breath was taken away because before me was Dimitri Spiridakis at 12 years old. He literally was a spitting image of Dimitri. And I was like, hi, William, nice to meet you. And I ran back into the room, and like my face was white. I said, Tony, it's Dimitri. And then William came in, and he and Bobby had this instant chemistry, and he like improvised. It was really weird, man. Casting is this strange metaphysical process that you just have to hang in there. And he was amazing. He really was every day.
So just absolutely, he was great. Quick follow-up about another cast member who's, there's a couple Bobbies here. The other Bobby is De Niro, who you've referenced and who John's worked with. For you as an actor and now as a director to be working with and directing Robert De Niro, how did you, was that slightly intimidating?
Yeah, it's terrifying. Yeah, I mean, and I've worked with some iconic individuals through my career, but yeah, I mean, Bob is like every actor's hero. So you just have to like, it's an out-of-body experience being in the room with him. And also, he's a very shy person, so he doesn't give you a lot. He doesn't make it easy. It's not like is, you know, like there's some actors, if you meet Tom Hanks or you meet Denzel or whatever, their like thing is like they want to make you feel comfortable when you're with the, you know, that they just know that people react to them. So they want everyone to feel cool. And they're real, and Bob's not like that. He's just like, how are you? Nice to see you. Okay. And then you get done. So you kind of got to, but it's ultimately, it's about the work. And I knew Bob was about the work. And you just got to throw down and be for real. And he was amazing and had brilliant ideas about the script and sort of very, you know, held us to, took us to task on the script. And then it was great. And also, so respectful of me and very old school. Like he would always call me. He's like, the director is this guy. And he would call me and like 5:30 in the morning, the phone would ring and it'd be like, Tony, I have Bob for you. I'd be like, what? I'm not dressed. And, hi, Bob. Hi, I just wanted to talk to you about the script. You know, on page for the scene, I was thinking about something. And he literally would call me, not irregularly, to just discuss something. And he cared so much. He took it very seriously. There's no phoning it in, man. And, you know, and he, at his costume fitting, he wanted me in the fitting with him, which is very unusual. You know, directors are not usually there with actors in the fitting, but Bob wanted me there. And it was like, it was amazing. It was really very thrilling. And, you know.
Last two things. I was there, I think it would have been September of last year at the Toronto International Film Festival where this movie had its world premiere, blew people away. The reaction there was tremendous. You guys end up now with Bleecker Street as your distributor. The movie's going out in May.
May 31st, tell your friends.
Tell your friends. just, you know, you've now, I guess, is this the fifth feature that you've directed?
Yeah.
You know, just talk about to see your baby go out into the world with this one, what that's been like. And then I'll have one last final question.
I would say about that, being in a room with you here tonight is what it's all about. I mean, that's how I look at it. Like I've learned to be very present with what I'm doing because everything you do, everything we do, we pour our guts into. And some things find an audience and some things don't, you know, and people have all different reactions. People, you know, share the exact passion that you have for something and other people don't get it at all. And so to be in a room with people who are experiencing something with us is the most important, the most gratifying thing, you know? Yeah. So that's what's so beautiful about film festivals like Boulder. You know, we get to come and share this, especially nowadays where honestly, most people don't watch movies in movie theaters.
Right.
So the communal experience is often not people's experience of movies. So that's sort of how I feel. I'm grateful every time I get to do this. And then May 31st, people will come out and, you know, hopefully people will dig it.
Yep.
And, you know, but it's I've just learned, that's the thing I've learned. It's always a white knuckle experience because you want someone to care about your baby the way that you do, but they don't. You know, I mean, no, you can't. It's impossible. Don't you love my child as much as I do? Like, you swear when you have a child, you swear, I will never show people baby pictures. As soon as you have a baby, you're like, you want to see a picture? You know? So making movies is kind of the same. And so, yeah, man, I'm grateful to all of you, and we'll see what happens.
And our last thing before we go is that's one exciting upcoming date on the calendar. In addition to what we said, March 10th is going to be, I think, Oppenheimer night. And then March 14th, after 30 years of playing Jack McCoy, the district attorney on Law & Order, Sam Waterston is stepping away and is being replaced or succeeded by Tony Goldwyn.
That's right.
This has got to be, for a guy who lives in the tri-state area, I can't think of a cooler, better job than that.
It's a pretty cool job,
right?
Yeah.
Can you give us any?
District Attorney Nicholas Baxter.
So just, I guess, looking ahead to that and just big picture, you know, I've forced you to go back down the whole memory lane, but in terms of what's coming up, what's your outlook right now?
Oh, it's awesome. It's great. I just can't believe I'm still able to do it. Literally, when Tony said, you're getting this award. Does this mean you're dying? I expect that any minute, you know, like, I can't believe I get to keep doing this. Cause I thought when COVID happened, I thought, oh, maybe I'm retired. Like, we're not working. The world stopped. Maybe this is it. And then stuff sort of, King Richard shows up and then some plays or whatever, you know, like, and then Tony sends me this beautiful script and I'm like, yeah, let's do this. I didn't know if I'd direct another movie again. I don't know if I will after this. I hope I do because I love doing it, but you just never know, man. And I'm going to direct a musical in the theater that we did a production of in New York in November. We're going to do it in Washington again. I've got a movie that I can't yet talk about that I'm super excited about acting in this spring, but I'm not allowed to speak of it, but I will.
That's great.
And then we'll do Law and Order for the next year or so and see how that goes. And
30 years later,
I don't know if it'll be 30 years, but it'll be at least a year and a half, and then we'll see.
Well, that's great. And so I want to, on behalf of everyone here, thank again the 2024 recipient of the Boulder International Film Festival Career Achievement Award, Tony Goldwyn.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you so much.
So fun talking to you. Thank you, everybody. I really appreciate you.
Thanks for listening to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate it and would really appreciate you taking just a minute more to subscribe to the podcast and to leave us a rating and review on your podcast app. And to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @AwardsChatter. On those platforms, we announce upcoming guests and provide details about special live recordings of the podcast that you can attend. Until next time, thanks again for tuning in.